Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. It's a special show today. We're bringing you a show we recorded in Aspen, Colorado at the Food & Wine Magazine Classic. Now, let me give you a feel for this event. This is the 20th anniversary of the Classic. This is the place superstars show up every single year. This is also the place where Food & Wine Magazine names its 10 best new chefs of the year. This is no small honor considering how competitive the food business is. It's like a three-ring circus with ongoing master classes, wine tastings, and seminars. And then there's the big tasting tent. Between classes, you roam and you sip. Now, this place is big enough for its own zip code. You're going to find winemakers, food producers, what's new, what's old. There's an Italian pavilion, a Spanish pavilion, and this year, Grana Padano cheese was everywhere. There is no food and wine event quite like this one. Now, we recorded this show in a jewel box of a theater, the historic Wheeler Opera House. You're going to be hearing from a lineup of luminaries, including star chef Mario Batali, our favorite woman in France, Patricia Wells, New York's master restaurateur, Danny Meyer, and that father and daughter team, Jacques and Claudine Pepin. But first, we're joined on stage by the woman who is essentially responsible for this bacchanal, Dana Cowan, editor-in-chief of Food & Wine Magazine.
Good to have you with us. Now, from what I understand, this event began 20 years ago. It's the 20th anniversary, right? Was the point of the Food & Wine Classic always that it was announcing the 10 best chefs of the year?
The point of the original event was really to bring wine lovers together to Aspen and Snowmass. It started as a teeny tiny event, a few hundred people in the mountains in the off-season. The best new chefs didn't come into the picture until 5 years later. So the best new chefs have been around for 15 years, and we love bringing 10 newly minted, incredible talents to Aspen to have them cook, probably for the only time in their lives, together for 800 people.
That's quite a challenge. Yes. Winners from that first time 15 years ago are here today as guest chefs, and three of them, Danielle Ballou, a restaurateur, French restaurateur from New York, Rick Bayless, Mexican food expert who has restaurants in Chicago, and Thomas Keller from the French Laundry restaurant in the Napa Valley. These were all the most one of the 10 most promising young chefs 15 years ago.
Yes, we think that our track record has been impressive. You know, you look at that first year, and they are among the great lights of today. And Nobu Masahisa was also in that class. George German and Joanne Killeen from El Forno in Providence, Rhode Island, also in that class. So the 88, you know how vintages of wine can be extraordinary? The 88 vintage was mind-blowing.
So tell me this. What is a typical day like for you here?
Well, a typical day involves an intro every hour and a half. So I get up and introduce, let's say, Mario Batali or Thomas Keller or Danielle Ballou, and get an audience excited about seeing them. Mm-hmm. Not a difficult task. Stand there for 10 minutes watching cooking demonstrations, hoping to pick up a quick tip, like with lobster, be sure you parboil before you do anything else. If you want to do something with lobster meat, that was from Thomas Keller yesterday. Then run off to an interview, do a really, you know, fast interview on radio or TV. Run to the tasting tent, taste as many wines as one can speed taste and spit in half an hour. Go back to a radio interview, go back to an intro, go back to the tasting tent, go back to an interview. Don't eat.
Don't eat.
Never eat. I never get to eat. I never get to sit down, so I never get to eat. And then sometime a meal rolls around, but they're all stand-up meals. And then I see lots and lots of people that I love because the whole food world is here. And then a fantastic group of people who read Food & Wine magazine are here. And that's my day. And then there are parties that go on until, I was going to say the middle of the night, but they really go on into the early morning. I don't do those parties. So my day ends at probably 11:30 while the rest of the party continues.
Do you ever get a chance to just kick off your shoes and sit back with a great bottle?
Not here.
All right. Well, Dana, thank you very much.
Dana Cowan is editor-in-chief of Food & Wine magazine. Now, check out the 10 best new chefs of the year in the July issue of Food & Wine. If you're just tuning in, we're bringing you a program we recorded at the Food & Wine magazine Classic in Aspen. And let me tell you, everybody was there. Now, if you watch the Food Network, you're familiar with our next guest, host of Molto Mario and Mario Eats Italy. If you eat in New York, you're probably still waiting for a reservation at his restaurant, Babbo. And if you love cookbooks, you probably have his newest, the Babbo Cookbook. Mario Batali joined us on stage in his full ponytailed shorts and orange sneakered splendor.
Good to have you here. Now, Mario, are you teaching classes here?
I am.
Do you do a lot of teaching?
Not so specifically. There's not a lot of time. I teach a lot of my prep cooks how to make sure they do everything just right every day. But the classroom environment is one that I almost exclusively reserve for the Aspen event that I love to come and do every summer here.
Yeah, you were saying that this event for you years ago had a slightly different tone to it. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Not particularly.
All right. Okay.
Yes, of course I will. But when I first got here, it was a very 3 o'clock in the morning caribou club kind of situation. And after the first 2 years, of which that was very enjoyable,
right.
I brought my kids last year, and it changed the whole event, and it's more enjoyable now, even more so.
All right, I want to talk about Mario Batali, the early years. Okay. Going back to the old days of soap opera. This story asks the question, how does a kid from Seattle who has a degree in Spanish theater end up cooking in a tiny town at the top of a mountain in Italy, a town nobody has ever heard of, in a family trattoria?
Pure luck.
Oh, come on. But, I mean, how did you...
When I graduated college, I thought, well... there's not a lot of career opportunities in Spanish theater. Being that they're all closed, and it was the golden age, really, that I studied the most. But I also trained in economics and thought that I was going to be a fascinating banker with a multinational company working in Madrid, which is where I went to high school, and I really had the idea of returning there.
Uh-huh.
But I was also very excited about cooking even before I went to college. And my parents actually suggested I go to cooking school instead of college. And I said, well, that's for sissies, Mom. So I didn't. And eventually I did. After college, I went to the Cordon Bleu. I didn't quite make it all the way through in London.
I hear you dropped out because of lack of interest.
Well, yeah. It wasn't lack of interest. I just thought it would be going faster. I kept saying, am I in the right class? Because I could already do some of this. It was a good program, and mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, when they're in any kind of a learning environment, also feel that it should be going quicker. And it was probably the right pace, and I was just a little impatient. But so anyway, I worked in California for a little while for Four Seasons Hotels, and at the grand old age of 28, had decided that I was done with that, and wrote some letters to some restaurants in Italy, and the only one that responded was this one place up above Porretta Terme, and that's where I ended up going and living for 3.5 years, and it was, without a doubt, the single most important thing I ever did for my career and for my own head.
Why?
Having lived in California, where simplicity seemed to be what cooking was all about, it was really not as simple as it really is in Italy. So when you make a dish of pappardelle and peas in Italy, it really only has pappardelle and peas. And to understand that is a giant step, especially for your ego, to get over the fact that you have to re-examine and redevelop a trend to just make something absolutely perfect and realize that the shopping is probably 80%. Getting the right pea is so much more important than the technical ability of the chef was probably the most important thing.
I want to talk about one of your 185,000 passions, the Salami Kitchen. Could you explain what that is?
Yes, in the back, we have a wine store in New York City called the Italian Wine Merchants. And as opposed to filling the whole room with cases after case after case of wine, what we have on our display is one single bottle of everything that we have. And it's more like a wine list than it is. We don't expect to have 40 Chiantis. We have 7 Chiantis. We chose 7 Chiantis, and these are the ones that we'd like you to try. So that left all this other space in the back that we didn't quite know what to do with. So I aced out like a room about a third as big as what the light covers here to create a salami curing room, which is where it hangs in the right humidity, which is about 55 degrees and 63% humidity for our uses. Mm-hmm. And then I created a really cold room at 38 degrees where we actually chop, grind, spice, and mix, and then stuff the salamis or the sopressatas or the copas or the prosciutti. So we're doing that on an experimental level and serving just the restaurants right now and having the time of my life.
So you have now discovered the pig, essentially.
Yes, exactly.
And what kind of pork are you working with?
Well, we started out working with just commercial IBP pork, which is a very interesting thing, and it's good, and it's what your pork chops mostly come out of. Then we started working with a ranch in Iowa called Neiman.
Yeah.
Then we discovered a Vermont Farmers Cooperative who will grow pigs to the sizes that we want, because one of the most important things that we wanted to make, one that we felt that wasn't made in America, was something called lardo, which is the back fat of the pig cured like a prosciutto, and to get it really nice, you have to have a pig that's grown to 500 pounds. Now, commercial pigs are generally raised to 2 to 250 pounds. Well, we convinced these ladies to grow them to 500 pounds, so we get this fat back like this, and we cure it like prosciutto and then slice it very, very thin. And for customers who aren't ready for something called lardo, we call it prosciutto bianco. and they go wild for this stuff.
White prosciutto.
White ham, basically.
But I have to explain something to our audience. This is eating pure fat, and it's like eating melting satin.
Right.
Americans are going to go crazy for this.
It's the next white meat, I guarantee.
Okay. Are you going to be doing more television? Is there going to be more Molto Mario and Mario Eats Italy?
Yes. The Food Network is a interesting group of people, and I love them dearly. But it is still the entertainment business, and my suggestion to anybody who is a cook and is interested in the entertainment business, don't give up your day job for a TV show. Although I've been on for 9 years now and I'm seemingly doing okay, seemingly, as I say. We're doing more Molto in December. We usually do 80 shows a year in two groups of 40. I'm going to do a couple of specials with Nigella Lawson this summer.
The luscious Nigella.
The luscious Nigella Lawson. And I'm doing two specials with Tony Bourdain, which are frightening right now to me. I'm not really sure exactly how that's going to work out. We're still working out the details.
Tony Bourdain is the author of Kitchen Confidential.
And a genius, a
brilliant writer and a chef. And he's the person who told you never to order fish in a restaurant on a Monday.
Well, his character is also kind of the dark side, and I am the side of light and truth.
One last question.
Yes.
Have you ever worn long pants and shoes that aren't orange?
Yes. In my opinion, the whole long pants cult is just about over. I'm far more comfortable in short pants. And sneakers, let's face it, if on any given moment you want to walk outside and take a couple of top-of-the-key jumpers, you can't do it in your fancy dress shoes. And quite frankly, in these, I can. So there you go.
Mario Batali, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Chef Mario Batali appears on the Food Network. He is chef owner of Babbo, and he's the author of the Babbo Cookbook. Coming up, Patricia Wells, Danny Meyer, and the Pepins from the Food & Wine magazine classic at Aspen. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. This week, we're bringing you a program from the 20th annual Food & Wine magazine classic at Aspen. Now, this is the reigning deity of food and wine events. The setting is gorgeous.
The festival runs like clockwork, and you're surrounded by fellow food lovers, and the people teaching the seminars are the stars of the food world. We recorded folks on stage at the historic Wheeler Opera House in front of a live audience, and our next guest got quite a welcome. She is our favorite American in Paris, an award-winning cookbook author, a gifted teacher, and the first American to become restaurant critic for France's prestigious L'Express magazine, Patricia Wells.
It's great to see you. It's great to be here again.
It's so good to have you up here. Now, I want to bring you back 21 years, okay?
Okay.
We first met in Paris 21 years ago, and I remember at that time I said to you, how long do you think you're going to be here? And you said, you know, probably another 2 years. It's going to be a great experience, and then we'll kind of be ready to go home. So, Pat, what did fate, what did fate deal you that
well,
you're still there?
My husband and I left New York City in 1976. 1980,
uh-huh.
with the idea of coming to Paris for 2 years. We're both journalists, and he was offered a job at the Herald Tribune in Paris. And I was a food writer at the New York Times, and we thought, well, gee, it's not Timbuktu. Paris is a good place to, you know, get your PhD
right.
in food.
Right.
And so we went with the idea of staying for 2 years. And at the end of 2 years, we said, well, gee, you know, our French could be a little bit better if we stayed a third year. And at the end of 3 years, we stopped asking questions, and I got a book contract. And as we like to say, we went for his job and stayed for mine. And 22 years later, we're still there and loving it more than ever.
Yeah, I'm curious, how did people react, the pros, I mean, to an American woman who wanted to know about what they were doing? I mean, was there some prejudice here?
The chefs loved me because they respected me. They respected my interests and the way I worked as a journalist. I mean, most French journalists would go into a restaurant, you know, announcing themselves, expecting to be taken care of, expected to be treated like kings. And I would go in, you know, under another name, and I would go 3 or 4 times. And by the time I'd made up my mind that this person was a good chef, mm-hmm. then I would introduce myself and so on and so forth. So the chefs were, I had them in my pocket. I mean, they still love me because I do my job,
yeah.
and they do
yeah.
their job. And so we have a lot of self-respect. The French critics hated me. I mean, they hated me. I've had chefs who said, I would never tell you what they say about you. Because
really?
I was, you know, I mean, I think it would have been much easier for a male journalist to come in and be part of their club. But it was fine with me because I didn't want to be part of their club anyway.
You've done a book now about your life in Paris, the Paris Cookbook.
Yes.
How did you get those recipes? Because, I mean, isn't there stuff like from your hairdresser?
And, yes, exactly.
And well,
there are two of my favorites, and the two of my favorite recipes. One is the taxi driver's wife's secret muscle recipe. No matter where I go to the dentist, the doctor, the hairdresser, even if I'm stuffed to the gills and don't even want to think about food, we have to talk about food. So here I was in this taxi, and somehow this guy figured out that I was involved in food. So he says, my wife has the best muscle recipe. I said, oh. She doesn't share it with anyone. I said, oh. He said, even when we invite guests over, they can't come in the kitchen while she's making the recipe because she wants to keep it a secret. Oh. So we drive on. He says, you want to know the secret? So he told me, and the secret is she uses Gewürztraminer in her wine instead of what other people might use, a Riesling or something.
And that has a note of spiciness and a hint
right,
of sweetness
right.
and that kind
and
of
it
thing.
Right, it was so funny. And of course, I've never seen the taxi driver again. I'm dying to know if she knows that he gave me the recipe.
You have a unique perspective because for all these years, you've been coming back to America, but you're kind of from looking at us from the outside, looking in. I'm really curious to see through your eyes what you perceive is happening in food here.
Well, you know, I would say every single year that, well, I've been back to the States every month this year, so I think I eat more here than I do in France now. We have made such strides. I think first of all in the ingredients, second of all both in wine and food, the availability, the understanding and the respect for ingredients. I think that chefs, thank goodness, are understanding that it's more about the food and less about them. So I think that we're getting humbler. The customer is becoming much more informed. And, God, I think we're almost there. We just have to know how to make a vinaigrette and toss a green salad. We haven't gotten there yet. But
so you're saying simple stuff is still tough.
Yeah, but I really think, I mean, if you look back 5 years or 10 years, we weren't there with the wine, we weren't there with the ingredients, we weren't there with the knowledge, we weren't there with the markets. I'm very impressed. I'm very excited about what we've done. And, you know, just Mario was talking about his prosciutto bianco. I love it.
Are we more open than, let's say, the French are?
Oh, definitely. Oh, without question. Because, I know one restaurateur always says that, you know, the French know everything without knowing nothing, anything, and Americans know nothing and are always willing to learn. You know, they're always curious. I mean, we're students. We continue to be students our whole life. And I think that's, you know, a great talent of ours. I think the only negative thing, which is still a big issue, is our fear of food. We still have so many negative, I can't do this, I can't eat this, I don't want to have that. If I do this, this will happen to me. And I think that instead of looking at food first with an eye towards pleasure, mm-hmm. we look at it too often with an eye towards fear.
Yeah.
And once we can get over that fear factor, we've got nowhere to go but up.
So now, what's on for the rest of the day for you?
I'm going to do book signing after this, and then I have a cooking class at 3:30.
What are you going to be doing?
I'm doing an apricot and fig tart made with fresh apricot jam. Ooh. And then an upside-down walnut and mushroom tart tatin. Because I feel that people, if they learn to make pastries and vinaigrettes, they're in good shape. So mm-hmm. I'm going to do some vinaigrette. And then I'm doing goat cheese wrapped with sprinkled with herbs and wrapped in bacon and then just sautéed to go
wonderful.
With the salad.
Okay.
It's good.
Pat.
It's pretty. In fact, I had some leftover for breakfast. It was good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pat Wells. Good to see you.
Patricia Wells' latest book is The Paris Cookbook. Now, you can get that recipe for Taxi Driver's Wife's Secret Muscles on the website at splendidtable.org. In case you've just joined us, we're bringing you a show from the Food and Wine Magazine Classic in Aspen, Colorado. We've been joined on stage by some of the heavy hitters in the food business, and our next guest is no exception. He is one of New York City's leading restaurateurs. He created the Union Square Cafe, Gramercy Tavern, and Tabla. His latest venture is Blue Smoke for barbecue and jazz. Mr. Danny Meyer.
I'd like to talk about the side of the classic that a lot of people never see. It's specifically for the trade. What kind of things go on for you folks?
One of the things that Food and Wine does an extraordinary job of is bringing together the top winemakers, the top chefs, the top restaurateurs, and of course the top most savvy restaurant goers. And what the trade program really involves is an opportunity for restaurateurs to hear from other restaurateurs to share experiences. We all face the exact same things every single day. I'm mm-hmm. kind of fond of saying the restaurant business is really kind of like surfing. It's a series of waves. You just never know what the next size is going to be and when it's going to come. Things go wrong in the restaurant business, and I think the best restaurants are the ones that handle the waves the best. And so we restaurateurs and chefs get to come together and talk with each other. It's almost like group therapy in a way. Talking about the types of waves that we all experience in common and how we deal with them.
I'd like to talk to you about trends. What do you see coming in restaurants at this point?
Realness.
What do you mean by realness? I mean, we've gone through bistro and we've gone through mashed potatoes and meatloaf.
And I think we're at a fabulous point in the evolution of dining out in this country where Americans, because of the extraordinary number of years of economic boom, in the 90s, had this great opportunity to travel. They know what sophisticated dining out is all about. They had an extraordinary opportunity to learn about wines, to collect good wines. The magazine business grew in the 90s, so we had a great opportunity to be educated.
Yeah, true.
Radio shows, TV shows, the internet. So now what we're ready for, and also during the 90s, when everybody was opening a new restaurant, the way that so many restaurants distinguished themselves were to hire a very expensive restaurant designer, and the stage set sort of became the thing in a way that you would never find in Rome. Sometimes you find it in Paris. We always use Rome as our example of what we want to be, because what's great about Rome is that if you go to almost any trattoria, the menu is exactly the same. And the only way that the restaurants distinguish themselves is by the hospitality they offer or by the slightly different way that the mama cooks the spaghetti alla carbonara or the bucatina alla matriciana. It's not distinguish themselves based on how creative they can be. It's how much love they can put into something. So now we're at a point where we've had the double whammy of an economic recession and then 9/11. And so fewer restaurants are opening, and they're opening with lower budgets. And what people, I think, want right now more than anything is realness. They want comfort. They want to go out to a restaurant that loves them. They want to go out to a restaurant that's on their side, mm-hmm. that's cooking real food with real ingredients, with real flavor, and you know, less of the sort of shenanigans that go on in the background. I don't think most people care about, you know, $90,000 light fixtures. They want a waiter who's on their side, who can describe the wine and food accurately. They want a bottle of wine that's delicious when you pull the cork, and they want a bill that's fair at the end of the day.
So a specific example of real food.
I think any kind of food that that relies on the seasons is real. I think green market cooking is real. Mm-hmm. I think regional cooking is real. It can be regional cooking from Italy, from France. We've just opened our barbecue restaurant, Blue Smoke, and it's based on real recipes from real pit masters and real recipes actually from my grandmother's cookbook, which I shouldn't even say a cookbook. I should have said a recipe book. It's a really ugly green plastic cookbook with spiral notebooks, and it's ripped. And there's, I got to just tell you a funny story. My grandmother lived in St. Paul. She grew up in St. Paul, uh-huh. and then moved down to Chicago, where she lived most of her life thereafter. And she was about 90 when she died a few years ago. So she grew up in the very beginning of this century. And back in those days, there was this this tradition that the Jewish women, particularly in those towns, would invite each other over, and they would go through this game where they would cook for each other. And whether or not what they cooked was any good, their friends would always say, "Oh, that's the best salad dressing I've ever had. Can you give me the recipe?" And then they would say, "Oh, no, I couldn't possibly give you the recipe." So they would go through this game all the time. And lo and behold, I get this cookbook, and I go through, and I remember all these great dishes that we used to have growing up. When I grew up in St. Louis, I would travel to Chicago all the time. And we took the potato salad recipe, and I gave it to our chefs at Blue Smoke, and I said, "I really, really want to have the potato salad recipe that my grandmother made, because it's so good." So I gave them the recipe, the secret recipe that she wouldn't give anybody. And they cooked it for me. And I got this huge smile on my face, because it took me right back to my childhood. She would make these box lunches that we would take down to Lake Michigan with the potato salad. And the next week, we hired our next group of cooks at the restaurant. When you're opening a restaurant, it's really easy for a chef to develop a recipe, but it's when the sous chefs are hired and the next cooks are hired that you then have to, it's like a game of telephone, and you have to wonder, are these recipes going to stay true to themselves? So the chef calls me and he says, "Danny, I want you to make sure that this potato salad is right now that we have the next cooks." So I go into the kitchen, and there's about eight cooks smiling at me as almost as they were like the cat that ate the mouse or something. And they put the potato salad in front of me. I'm going, "What's so funny, guys?" I taste it. It's absolutely perfect. And they said, "Danny, we just want you to know something about your grandmother's secret potato salad recipe." And I said, "What's that?" Whereupon they took a jar of Hellman's mayonnaise, turned it around. It was the exact same recipe on the back of the Hellman's mayonnaise.
Well, now, I know that, first of all, the idea of a barbecue restaurant in New York, I mean, how are New Yorkers reacting to this? I just don't picture barbecue in New York. Maybe that's my own.
Yeah, I think barbecue is a foreign subject in New York, and it's kind of interesting because New York has every single type of cuisine under the sun. We have Australian cuisine, Vietnamese, Thai, Spanish, you name it. It's all over the place, and yet there hasn't been a lot of barbecue. And the only real reason I can think of is that barbecue has tended to grow up in more rural areas, often based on very limited types of budgets and, you know, roadside smoking opportunities. And you can't smoke things in New York without getting into huge trouble. There's a lot of herbs that get smoked in certain other parts of the city, but we're talking about... So to do this in New York... You're taking something that is a reasonably inexpensive way of dining out, you know, pulled pork, shoulder, and St. Louis-style spare ribs are not in and of themselves very, very expensive. Mm-hmm. But when you spend the money necessary to ventilate and to get the type of permits necessary to do this in New York, you now have to make a place that has to be very, very busy just to survive, and because you can't make it too expensive. So it is a very different thing. New Yorkers are flocking to Blue Smoke. They're looking, they're enjoying it. It's about twice as busy as we had expected it to be. On the other hand, there are a handful of New York restaurant critics so far who have had a difficult time understanding it. And it's almost as if they think that barbecue just does not belong in New York City. But one of the things that we found fascinating is that we actually love this because this restaurant is doing what a real restaurant should do. It's tapping into deep, emotional, evocative recipe centers in people's souls.
In what way?
In that every single thing on our menu, everything on their menu, is something that your grandmother probably cooked better than we will, at least in your mind. So whether you take the Green Goddess salad dressing or the bacon Roquefort salad dressing or the deviled eggs or the coleslaw or the potato salad or the barbecue sauce or the devil's food cake or the macaroni and cheese, and I could go on and on and on, or the brisket, it's something that you have some type of taste memory with. And very much like jazz, which we're also doing at the restaurant, it's an American form of something that is based on improvisation and doing things the way you want to do them. And so whatever point of view we have in the restaurant is either something that taps into your memory in a way that makes you cry because it takes you right back to how your grandmother made it, or it makes you furious because your grandmother would have put sweet pickles in the potato salad and my mother or my grandmother didn't. So it's actually, the place is packed, people are having a great time, but depending on who you are and where you come from, it's really very much like religion and politics. You've got a deep point of view on it, and you ain't going to budge.
We have a question from the audience. Yes.
Hi. First of all, I want to thank you, Danny, for the Union Square Cafe cookbook, from which I have never had a failure, especially the duck with rigatoni, which is spectacular.
That makes me feel especially good because that's one of the two recipes that came from my home kitchen.
Yeah, really? Good one. How do you modify a restaurant recipe for a home kitchen?
That's a great question, and that has probably been the most challenging and important part of both of our cookbooks, the Union Square Cafe cookbook and Second Helpings from Union Square Cafe. There's an inherent problem with restaurant cookbooks, and that is that what works so well in the restaurant may not work so well in your home. And when Michael Romano, my partner, and I decided to write both of the cookbooks, we agreed that we would hire an outside cook who's a very good home cook. And what they do is they come into our restaurant. Michael will cook the recipe as we cook it at Union Square Cafe. And the recipe tester will be feverishly scribbling notes. And they'll do the best job they can to approximate what they saw in our kitchen, and they'll cook it. And when they get their recipe to the point that they think it's like ours, they bring it to us, and we taste it. And I would say that 60% of the time it's right on the money, and 40% of the time it needs an adjustment. And that is the entire success of the cookbook right there.
Testing, testing, testing.
And out of the restaurant.
Yeah. Oh, Danny Meyer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Danny.
That was New York restaurateur Danny Meyer. Danny is co-author of Second Helpings from the Union Square Cafe. Now, you can get Danny's duck rigatoni recipe on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, more from the 20th anniversary Food & Wine magazine classic, including Jacques and Claudine Pepin. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio for PRI. Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. We're doing something a little different this week. We're coming to you from the Food and Wine Magazine Classic in Aspen, Colorado. This is a mind-boggling event. Nonstop cooking classes, wine tastings, all kinds of seminars, and then there's Walking the Grand Tasting Tent. It's the size of a small town, and it is packed with people wanting to feed you samples of their wares. I figured as long as our legs and our livers held out, we were going to be in great shape. Now, we've recorded a series of interviews with some of the participants. As I mentioned earlier, the Classic is celebrating its 20th year. There is one person who has been coming to this event longer than most, Jacques Pepin. He came this year with his daughter, Claudine.
Welcome to both of you. Good to see you. Hello, Claudine. I haven't seen you in a couple of years. I have to sort of tell a tale out of school, because I remember, Jacques, when I first met you, it was a long time ago in Brooklyn, New York, at a department store, Abraham and Strauss.
Oh, gosh, that's a long time.
A long time. Jacques would come to do demos for us in the store. And when there was a break, you'd come upstairs to the offices, and on a hot plate, this man who was chef to Charles de Gaulle, who was whatever, would make omelets for everybody.
Oh.
I've never forgotten that. I've also never had an omelet that good since then. So what was the Food and Wine Classic like in the beginning?
Well, the Classic has been a great ride for me. I mean, I've been here 17 years out of the 20 years of the Classic, and the first couple of years, they were doing only wine anyway. And it has really grown incredibly, and it's so organized, it runs so well. I mean, things are so good this year, better than ever, that it's really a great joy that you meet so many friends here, you know. And Claudine?
Oh yeah, no, it's a yearly reunion.
Now, were you coming with your dad at that time?
No, 17 years ago. I think this is either my fifth or my sixth year.
Okay, and now you two are doing a master class together.
We did.
We just finished.
You just finished. Yeah. What did you do in the master class?
We did pâte à choux, and we did it in four different ways.
Cream cups to those of us, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And we did gnocchi and sweet, savory. We did gougère, and just to sort of no protein, sorry, but just a whole lot of wonderful, wonderful, yummy stuff.
And all essentially from the same formula.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
And that's sort of the fun of it, because I think people think of profiteroles, but they don't think of all the savory that you can do with this.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he said.
I'm curious of what it was like to grow up in this household.
To grow up with her?
Well, I figure you're prejudiced in a different way being your dad, but I'm curious from Claudine's point of view. What was it like?
I know I ate better than most people, and I know that the only people that ever wanted to trade sandwiches with me when I was in high school was the staff, the teachers. Because I had duck or, you know, I had crazy pâté. And they were very excited to give me money or to trade sandwiches with me.
You could start a little business right on the
side,
right?
I could have. But the other kids never wanted, you know, like pâté.
Yeah. Well, from what I understand, your mother's background is Cuban and Puerto Rican. So
yes.
Were there ever debates in the kitchen? Among you and Jacques, among you and your wife, as to
no, there is fusion, not debate. You know,
I see.
Yeah,
I see.
Now we cooked all kind of different things. And you know, I've been married 37 years, and I've learned after that amount of time, if ever we have an argument we don't agree, then we do what Gloria wants. If we agree, we do what I want. Everything is fine now. We have no more problem.
Well, Claudine, you've gotten your master's degree and your bachelor's degree, but what were you studying?
International relations, European military systems.
All right.
Now she's selling wine.
And you know what the next question is going to be.
Well, how I got to here?
Yeah, kind of. How you got there first.
It's just what I love studying in college. I was lucky enough to go to Brussels, and I interned at NATO for a little bit, and it was a wonderful experience. I couldn't really do what I wanted to do. And my father asked me, it was for August, I was living in Boston and I had no air conditioning. And he said, look, I'm going to do a series. I think you'd be a great co-host. We'll do some shows. We'll go to dinner every night. and do you want to do it? And I thought to myself, okay, I'm going to spend 6 weeks with my father. We're going to go out to dinner every night. We didn't get to spend that much time together because he was traveling and I was away at school.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do a little bit of work. I don't have to do dishes, and there will be air conditioning in San Francisco. I can almost be assured of that. I said, yeah, great.
Stay at the Ritz-Carlton, so.
Yeah.
What could be bad?
Yeah.
So that's how you two started doing television together.
Mm-hmm.
It was.
I had no idea what I was getting myself into at all.
Well, we already had done show because I did 3 series called 2 Days Gourmet, and in those she did a couple of shows with me.
Mm-hmm.
And she loved it. She's very natural, good in front of the television. As opposed to my wife, which we really have to twist her arm to make her come on television. She hates it and doesn't like to go. And
mm-hmm.
So she's done a few shows because we kind of forced her. But
yes.
Claudine loved this. She's very natural, so we had a good time.
So now, Claudine, you're now selling wine.
I'm the brand ambassador for Moët & Chandon and Dom Pérignon Champagne in Manhattan.
Just out of curiosity, where do you want to be in 10 years? What do you want to be doing?
Well, I'm getting married. My fiancé is right over there.
Here.
Congratulations.
And we're going to open a restaurant. We're moving to Portland, Oregon. And we hope to open a restaurant after about 1 to 2 years after we're there. Or maybe in Napa. I don't know.
And what kind of food are you thinking about?
Raleigh style of food is...
International.
International relations. No. It's sort of country... French. If your grandmother was French, this is what she'd be making.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way he
mm-hmm.
describes it.
Mm-hmm.
So we go back to a blue smoke French style. Yeah.
Yeah, but it goes back to what Danny said about real food.
Sure.
Yeah, it's
food.
Real food.
And that kind of thing.
Yeah, people don't realize. I mean, in France, certainly they see French chef like me. And certainly during the time of Nouvelle Cuisine, it become very well known with chefs like Bocuse, Guérard, Verger, and so forth. Those are all 3-star restaurants. However, there is 23-star restaurants in France, and there is 138,000 restaurants in France. Most people in my family have never eaten in a 3-star restaurant. So even though 3-star cooking is part of the French repertory of cooking, it's only a very, very tiny, small part, more elitist, more expensive,
mm-hmm.
more esoteric, and so forth. And when you get to the real root of cooking, real French cooking, it's still mostly woman. You know, I mean, my mother, I came out of a restaurant 52 years ago. I left home to go into apprenticeship. Home with a restaurant where my mother was the chef. And an aunt in Valence with another restaurant. Another aunt in Nantua with another restaurant. I had 2 cousins female in Bourg-en-Bresse now, which have a restaurant. And my niece in Lyon with a restaurant. I mean, I'm by far the first male to go into that business, you know.
Oh, so you're reminding me of someone I knew in France who said to me she married only to produce another daughter so that they could open another restaurant.
Oh, yes.
Yes, which I thought was
interesting. That's what I did, you know.
Yeah, I see. You produced a daughter. Yeah. So the female tradition will continue through Claudine.
Hopefully.
Yes, exactly. I realize when you were coming to, several years back, coming here to the Classic, Julia was also a regular. Was
You're
that
right.
where you two started cooking together?
No, I know Julia 41 years. You know,
really?
I knew her with Helen McCauley. Just after I came in the United States, I worked at the Pavilion in New York. Within a year, less than a year, I knew Craig Claiborne because he came to the Pavilion and all that. We start getting
the food
friend,
critic and food editor
the food
of the New York,
the New York Times.
In
fact, we got married in Craig's house 37 years ago. We did the wedding. Through Craig, I knew Helen McCauley. And through Helen, I knew James Beard right away because Helen and James Beard every day spent at least an hour on the telephone. And I knew Julia. So, I mean, it was... The food world was much smaller than now. You know?
Helen McCauley kind of took you under her wing, didn't she?
Yeah, she was kind of my surrogate mother. You know.
Why don't you explain who she was? Because I think a lot of people...
Helen was the food editor of McCall and House Beautiful. She was a very feisty, terrific lady. She died in 1976. She came from Nova Scotia originally, you know, and she lived in New York next to me on 52nd Street.
Now, what did Helen McCauley actually do for you?
Helen was very feisty, and she told me, you have to do this, you have to do that. I went back to school. Well, I wanted to go back to school, but she pushed me into that direction. I start writing for House Beautiful with her. She always kind of pushed me to better myself. Don't dress this way. Don't wear those small socks you have in France. Put things on your hair. No.
Lose the beret.
Yeah. Helen would say, okay, you're coming for dinner tomorrow. I have some people, and I usually end up cooking. She said, don't wear that shirt you had the other day. And not with. Okay.
But now you went from cooking in Pavillon, which at that time was one of the fanciest, most elegant restaurants in New York. And then, if you'll pardon the expression, you opened a soup kitchen, right?
No. First, I went to work for Howard Johnson.
There's a contrast. Right. There's a contrast.
Actually, in the summer of 1960, well, at the Pavillon, when Kennedy was running for president, I was offered a job at the White House, and then I was offered a job for Howard Johnson, so I went to Howard Johnson.
Why?
And I stayed at Howard Johnson for 10 years, from 1960 to 1970. Then I opened that restaurant in New York.
But why not the White House?
Well, you know, in the context of the time, people are that. But in retrospect, you say, why? But, you know, as a chef at that point, I would never have been on a stage like this. I had been chef to three presidents in France, finishing with De Gaulle. I had never been on a newspaper, on a magazine, on a radio show. Television didn't exist. It just did not exist, period. At the Pavillon, we were part of Local 89, which was the dishwasher, the cook, everyone on the social...
Your union.
On the social scale, the chef was really at the bottom... part of the spectrum, and any good mother would have wanted her child to be a lawyer and a doctor, certainly not a chef. And now we are genius. So this, I don't know what happened. But
So the Howard Johnson job was sort of now you wear a suit and tie.
Well, in that context, you know, I had no inkling of the possibility of the promotion of the White House, because I had done that in France and it was fine. So I was studying in New York already. I was in New York and I wanted to get away from a French environment, the restaurant and all that, to work in a purely American environment. Not that the White House is not purely American, but in an organization like Howard Johnson, I learned about marketing, mass production, chemistry of food, many, many things that I didn't know, the American eating habit. So it was my true American apprenticeship, you know, for 10 years.
In that context, it makes sense.
Yeah.
When you've cooked for three presidents, I guess it's kind of no longer as interesting.
Well, it's not that, but it was. There was no prestige where there was to it, but there was no... you know, even in Paris, when I said, where do you work? I had worked at the Place Athénée, Maxime Fouquet's. Mm-hmm. It was more prestige even to work in those famous restaurants than to work at La Présidence. You know, it wasn't considered. It was fine, but...
Mm-hmm. So, Claudine, what are you going to be doing for the rest of the time here? The master class is finished?
The master class is finished. I have to look at his schedule to see what else we have to do. I would love to go to the tent and taste some wines. There's going to be Best New Chefs is tonight.
Right.
And then a rad party at Jimmy's after that. And I'm very much looking forward to. Uh-huh. You're coming, right?
I did last night until 2:30. I shouldn't have drunk those bourbon. You know, so I should have sick with the wine.
And then tomorrow we're going to do Ready, Set, Cook.
You know the...
Oh, yes. The now, this. Yes. Why don't you explain how that works, Ready, Set, Cook?
Ready, Set, Cook. What they do is they give you a whole bunch of ingredients, and you don't know what they're going to be, and they uncover them, and you have 18 minutes, I believe, or 20 minutes...
17 minutes, yeah.
...to create a meal, and you want to do as many courses as you can, and it is so fun. And they have a basic pantry.
One again the other, you know.
Yeah, they have... There are two teams, and they have a pantry with olive oil and flour and salt and pepper and some vegetables and some fruit and so on. So you have the basics, and then you have to use what they give you. You have to use everything. And sometimes they'll have a mystery ingredient. I think last year we had Wonder Bread, which
we had snake.
Well, we had snake as the... We knew that right away, but our mystery ingredient was Wonder Bread. Yeah. Which
what
my father,
did you do with Wonder Bread?
He took it, he looked at it, and then he took it and he threw it into the audience.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know that I was supposed to use it. I wanted to see whether it bounced back, you know, because I have heard that.
Only when I think you roll it into the ball.
Oh, he did. Yeah. He smushed it.
Isaac, who are your opponents?
Last year, we had Keith Famey, who was on Survivor.
Yes.
Remember the chef Survivor? He was our opponent.
He could cook?
He's a chef. I knew him for a long, long time from Detroit.
Really?
Yes.
Really? Yeah,
good
chef. Took flour, and we needed the flour because we had the snake.
Yeah.
And I asked him for the flour, and he took the flour, and he threw it at me, so I was literally covered in flour. My father very calmly, this was my hero, right? My father very calmly took up a big knife and walked over to him and said, "What did you do to my daughter?"
I don't think anybody's going to want to miss this. So who are you?
Who, it's a lot of fun.
Who are you up against this week?
I'm not playing. I'm cheering.
See, I think you are.
Oh, I don't know. Bugielli?
Oh, boy. Giuliano Bucciali, the famous Italian food expert.
Right. He's serious.
He's very serious.
He's really serious.
This is going to be very exciting. But you're not taking any chances because you were covered with flour last year.
Mm.
I saw you two in action several years back, and I thought you were really dynamite because you have to think on your feet. You have 17 minutes. This is not easy.
Just open a bottle of wine to start with, you know. Things get better.
Oh, Claudine, Jacques, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
very much.
Jacques Pepin and Claudine Pepin's latest series is Jacques Pepin Celebrates on PBS. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks to Food & Wine Magazine, the historic Wheeler Opera House, Roaring Fork Public Radio, KAJX, and to Nick Kariakis for his technical wizardry. Now, remember, you really can call us at any time. The number's 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with one last thought. A balanced diet is a glass of champagne in each hand. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to The Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website at splendidtable.org. Now, our program is produced by Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell, and this week, Joel Scott. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper.